Welcome into another edition of the NBC Sports Pro Basketball Talk Podcast. I am Brett Polikoff. Kurt Heelan is a travel day for him, so he will not be joining us this week, but we do have Dominic Ridgard of NBC Sports. What is going on, Dom?
Hey, Brett. How you doing? I hope you enjoyed that game last night. It was a great one.
You know, I enjoyed maybe the third quarter.
Yeah.
That was about it. But we'll get into it. We're going to go ahead and break down everything we saw out of game four. Warriors obviously, you know, had a big victory, 103-82. Basically got back to playing their style of basketball. Big change they made was in the starting lineup. Andre Iguodala, who'd been doing a great job against LeBron James the entire series, he gets the start. Andrew Bogut goes to the bench. Didn't work out right away as the Cavaliers jumped out to a 7-0 lead, but overall it was a positive change for the Warriors, who, you know, led after the first quarter, got their tempo and pace going a little bit. You know, before we get into the breakdown, I want to talk about Steve Kerr, who had two meetings with the media yesterday, one in the morning shoot around and one, you know, customary about 90 minutes before tip off.
Yep.
Basically flat out lied.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, twice. You know, in the morning said there was no change, and then he was asked straight up again, you know, before the game. I'll read you his quote, and then we can talk about what we think about that. So he said, he basically admitted it, first question in the post-game press conference, that I lied. I figured I have two press conferences on the day of the game, so I'm asked a lot of strategic questions. My options were to tell the truth, and I was asked both the shoot-around and before the game. So if I tell the truth, it's the equivalent of me knocking on David Blatt's door and saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. I could evade the question, which would start this Twitter phenomenon, who is going to start for the Warriors, or I could lie, so I lied. And then this is the part I like the best. He finished that by saying, sorry, but I don't think they hand you the trophy based on morality. They give it to you if you win.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that? I mean, you know, initially I was like, why even have press conferences if we're just going to be lied to straight up like that? But then once I heard the explanation and thought about it more, I'm actually kind of okay with it. What's your take?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought he handled it perfectly, you know. I agree with him that if he just flat out says, yeah, I'm changing the starting lineup, I'm going to put Iguodala in for Bogut, like that's basically showing your cards to the Cavaliers, which immediately kind of you strike that one out. So, you know, he says he had three options. He really had two. He either avoids it entirely and he starts this whole who's going to start for the Warriors thing, and that'll get back to the Cavaliers as well. They'll know a change is coming somehow. Or you can just say, I'm going with the same starting five and flat-out lie, which I completely agree with him. They don't give out the trophy for morality. They give it out if you win. And he has to do what's in the best interest for the Warriors, not the media, not for you and I or anybody else. You know, he has to do it for the Warriors. So that's what he did. He held his cards closest to the vest as he could. Eventually, it came out a couple minutes before tip that he was changing his starting lineup. And I think what served him the most, or what helped him kind of avoid any kind of criticism, is he owned up to it. He didn't dance around it or even try and say, you know, it was a last second change. Like, he said, no, I lied to you guys. I felt like I had to, and I'm sorry, but that's just kind of how it was. It's interesting that, you know, at first I saw a lot of the reaction from the writers and different reporters. They were a little upset. They weren't happy that they were lied to. But now, like you said, I feel like a lot of them, Kurt did a great job of kind of roping them back to his side, kind of saying, you know, I'm sorry, but that's something I had to do. You know, as a guy who was in locker rooms a lot and in those press conferences a lot, did you kind of feel like you were misled? Were you a little upset with the kind of, I guess, your fellow peers and counterparts were misled in that way?
You know, like I said, initially I figured, like, why are we even going to have these press conferences if that's what's going to go on? But you know, I think Kerr, his personality and the way he handles things is what sort of gets him off the hook here. If this was Greg Popovich doing one of his stone-faced, yeah, you know, jerky responses that he's known for, it might have been a little bit of a different reaction. But Kerr's always cracking jokes.
Yeah.
You know, he's lighthearted for the most part. And I think, you know, that sort of got him off the hook. I mean, media tends to take themselves way too seriously in these situations. Like, you know, I always say, this isn't the White House press corps.
Yeah.
We're covering a basketball game. Like,
Seriously. No,
you
I
know,
agree.
Kind of who cares. But here's what's funny is that, you know, Alvin Gentry, obviously one of the lead assistants on Steve Kerr's staff, when he was head coach of the Suns and other teams would not turn in, would not give their lineup until right before tip-off. Like, you know, Eric Spoelstra does that from time to time. There's a couple other coaches in the league that are known for doing that. You know, you don't have to announce it 45 minutes ahead. You only have to announce it a few minutes before tip-off. You know, Alvin Gentry used to just laugh and go, hey, unless LeBron James is going to be checking in and I didn't know about it, it really doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
No. And in this case, honestly, I think if Kerr would have sort of revealed it at the pregame press conference, I don't know how much difference that makes. I don't know if, you know, an hour and 15 minutes before tip-off is enough time for David Blatt to make all kinds of crazy adjustments. So it's fine. You know, it is what it is. No. And, you know, it ended up working out. You know, the Cavaliers killed the Warriors on the boards the first few possessions of the game, got out to that early lead. But eventually, there was too much speed on the floor for Cleveland, and they couldn't hang. So what did you see, you know, to start the game from Andre Iguodala and that Warriors lineup?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You said, just real quick, you said that it probably wouldn't have made a difference. And I think Steve Kerr would probably admit that too. But I think what he would say is, you know, I couldn't take that chance, you know?
Yeah,
I'm just not gonna risk it. I'm just gonna wait until the last possible minute so you reveal my real starters. But
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It at first, you know, like you said, they got out to that 7-0 lead and they were getting beat on the boards pretty hard, and everybody was a little like everybody watching was a little tentative. Like then a big change came, and so it's like, how is this gonna work? If it doesn't work right away, will Steve Kerr overreact? And to his credit, again, he didn't. One of the big sound bites that came out of the game, you know how they have the coaches wired. One of his sound bites was, you know, they're feeding off the crowd right now. They have good energy. They play seven guys. They're going to get tired. We're not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was a great message. You know, he basically said, calm down. You know, they're at home. They started out hot. It's going to work out in our favor. We just have to stay patient. And it did. I thought I promise you, Brett, I have physical evidence via direct messages on Twitter and text that I loved the change even before, you know, we saw how it was going to work out. I thought that, you know, Steve Kerr, I think you brought it up in a previous podcast, said, you know, we're 80-17 or whatever the number is. Like, why do we need to change? But I think he realized after game three, like, I don't have time to wait on these guys to see if they start to play better. Or, you know, we're at a critical juncture in this series. I need to make something happen as a coach. You know, if the players don't play well, like, he can only control so much. But I think he realized, like, I have to do something to help our team. You know what I mean? I can't just roll the same guys out there and tell them to play better. Sometimes you could say that, but that's not always how it works. So I thought it helped speed the pace up, which was big. And Andre Iguodala has actually been shooting really well this season. I know the knock on him sometimes is he's open for a reason, and we saw the Cavs had no problem switching Timofey Mozgov on him and almost pulling a Steve Kerr, putting Bogut on Tony Allen and just saying, go ahead and shoot it. But Iguodala knocked enough of them down to have a significant impact, and he was one of the main guys who helped speed the game up in transition.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the pace of the game, and Steve Kerr talked about it afterwards. He said it really helped our pace and our rhythm. You know, in terms of how pace is defined, you know, along the advanced statistical lines, it really didn't speed up. It was actually slower than the last two games that the Cavaliers won. Dan Feldman has a post up this morning, you know, breaking it all down from a number standpoint. You know, that game had 91.6, you know, possessions. Mm-hmm. You know, the previous two games were 93.9 and 96.7. So it was a more slowly played game in terms of how many possessions were, but what I do think happened was that the Warriors were much quicker in running through their offense. Just a lot of speed that the Cavaliers were unable to deal with, even if it didn't yield additional possessions. But look, in the first quarter, that was a fast quarter. I mean, the Warriors had 26 of their 77 field goal attempts for the game were in that first quarter. So they were able to speed things up early. and the lineup change, I think, was a big reason why. But, you know, more than anything, more than pace, I kind of think the reason the Warriors were so successful was space. I mean, the Cavaliers were not up on them the way they were the previous couple games. They weren't in their jerseys. They weren't able to stick with them. I really just think the speed, you know, actually killed the Cavaliers in this one.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you mentioned, like, there's certain analytics that point to the pace of play. And it's always hard to, when you all encompass like the full 48, especially with a game like this that got out of hand in the fourth quarter, and it kind of became that, okay, like we're waiting for the game to end at this point. Once they got up big, you know, David Blatt waved the white flag with about 4 or 5 minutes left.
Yeah,
and then that third quarter was the one that I think Cleveland did a good job of kind of slogging down and bringing it back to their pace, but. Like you said, it was more about watching the quote unquote eye test and watching how the Warriors play offense. Are they moving quicker? Are they getting into their sets quicker? Are guys attacking the rim, I guess, with a little more intensity? And I thought that was definitely palpable in the first quarter. And to your point about, you know, them, you know, with the Warriors having a lot more space, the thing is I agree with you, but I think they were still giving the space to the guys they wanted to shoot. You know, like Iguodala had 15 shots, the second most on the team behind Curry. And I think that was designed that they wanted him to shoot a lot. You know, I think he nailed a lot of shots, and I think he did a good job getting out in transition. The same thing with Draymond Green. Draymond Green took the third most shots with 11, and it was clear that the Cavaliers wanted him to be a playmaker and to be a shot taker. I don't think it's as simple as they were just hitting them now. You know, that's part of it. I think part of it is, you know, when they play at their pace, they feel more comfortable. So those shots that they were missing in games 2 and 3 kind of felt more natural in this one, or at least looked more natural in this one.
Well, yeah, and Draymond Green has been terrible the entire series. So there's something to wanting him to shoot. And look, he, you know, is one person that did finally, you know, start hitting the shots. When, you know, he hit a three at one point, I was like, okay, this game's over. Because
yeah.
You know, he's finally hitting the open shots that he'd been missing the entire series. Mm-hmm. You look at, you know, the NBA tracks everything, you know, statistically. You look at the amount of contested shots versus uncontested shots the Warriors had. First time all series they've had more uncontested shots than contested in game four. It was 43 uncontested, 34 contested. Every other game, game one it was even, but games 2 and 3, the majority of their shots were contested. So there is something to the fact that the Cavaliers just couldn't check the Warriors the same way that they had, you know,
Absolutely.
In these previous games.
Absolutely, and fatigue was probably a huge part of that. You know, this is what I think Blatt said, it's their third game in 5 days. And to your earlier point, the Cavs have to just bust their ass so hard on every possession just to kind of just to keep, I guess, that the offensive dam from breaking. And they just didn't have it. Like, I don't think it's an excuse. I think it's a reason, you know. I think there's a difference between those two words. One of the reasons is they didn't have the legs anymore to really chase them off screens, to chase them off the three-point line. You know, like I said, the point about Andre Iguodala in having the 15 shots – you know, those were shots that they gave up in the previous games, but they were at least making the attempts to run them off, or at least, you know, give the contest running up and putting the hand up. They would stare at him like and turn around and get ready for a rebound or a make. You know, and those are very small differences that can change a make or miss, and they can change a game.
Yeah, I mean, the Cavaliers were exhausted. I mean, even from the opening tip, you know, the big story. I mean, and it's the finals, so every little thing is a big story. But, you know, with Matthew Dellavedova having to go to the hospital to get, you know, an IV after the last game, you know, they were monitoring his hydration and all that stuff. So he said, well, I'm going to skip my pregame coffee.
Yeah.
Well, that didn't work out so well. You know, he needed some sort of energy in that first quarter, and it just wasn't there. And then, you know, it was on Twitter that at halftime, you know, coffee was back in the locker room, you know, so the stimulant story, you know, on the Cavaliers. But definitely, I mean, Cleveland was exhausted. You know, LeBron made a comment a couple days ago about how, hey, we noticed that our home games, the schedule is every other day, and the Warriors have time off before their home games, the final schedule is the same every single year.
Yeah.
It's on the same days. It's Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday. That's, you know, or starts on a Friday maybe sometimes, but that, these days are the same every single year if you look back. So, you know, there's nothing nefarious at play. The final schedule is set, good, you know, basically at the beginning of the season. There was talk about that move-up date, but you can't do that with the amount of travel and media and all that stuff and broadcasting windows. You know, the finals were set to start on June 4th forever, you know, the entire season. So
exactly. Get the one seed if it's that big of a deal.
Yeah, if it's a problem, right? Get the one seed. Play harder during the regular season. But, yeah. No, Cleveland is definitely exhausted, and I think, you know, they had to exert so much energy in that third quarter to make that comeback. That was the only time the entire game where Cleveland looked like the Cavaliers team that we had seen in the previous two contests. You know, LeBron James plays all 12 minutes in that third quarter, basically does everything. You know, I'd like to see, you know, in that third quarter, by the way, LeBron, 10 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists. All right, that's, I mean, that's as much as you can expect out of anybody
in,
you know,
a single
playing
quarter.
All 12 minutes.
Yeah,
but I think, I honestly think David Blatt has to look at his rotations with LeBron and figure out better times during the game to get him some rest. Because once again, in this one, he sits LeBron to start the fourth, which, you know, in theory makes sense because you get the timeout between quarters to get him a few extra minutes.
Yep.
He sits him to start the fourth, and just like game three, the Warriors go on a run because there's just nobody on the floor that's been able to make a play when LeBron's headed to the bench. And in game three, the Cavaliers had that huge lead, so it didn't matter. They were able to stabilize. But in this one, Curry hits that three at the end of the third. They go on that run with LeBron on the bench, and it's over. You know, I think they've got to find different ways or mix it up a little bit, you know, to get LeBron some rest at different points during the ball game. You know, it's a problem when LeBron goes to the bench. Nobody on the Cavaliers is capable of making a play. And you look at who the Warriors have out there, and they still have Curry and Klay Thompson out there. You know, it's basically, that's death at that point for the Cavaliers.
Absolutely. You know, and it, I think the term for it is stealing minutes. You got to find ways to steal minutes for LeBron, like somewhere,
yeah.
Somewhere. If it's, you know, and I think Kurt mentioned it on our last podcast. If you see Steve Kerr rest Klay Thompson and Steph Curry at the same time, you know, pull, that's when you take LeBron out and hope that you can play to an even draw for at least 2 minutes, you know? You can't. Well, now that there's more, I think this was the case test, or if there was a time to try and steal those kind of minutes for LeBron, it was this specific game. Because now that you've got the extra day's rest, I think his body will recover more. I think this will probably be the game where they were the most tired, probably for the rest of the series. So if there was ever a time that he needed to do it, it was game four. And I think he missed that opportunity. You know, if you notice that the Warriors are in a little bit of an offensive lull, like in that third quarter, maybe you say, okay, let's try and steal LeBron 2 minutes here and hope someone makes a play. Hope we could slow it down, get to the line. But, you know, it was the game where you could tell it was the game where they obviously missed a Kyrie Irving or a Kevin Love the most, where you can run an offense through a secondary player. You know, you can run the offense through someone else, and LeBron can take a possession off on offense. Like he can even still be on the court, but he could stand in the corner and spot up, you know, or set a pick and kind of half-heartedly roll to the rim. He can't do that even when he's on the court. He can't take possessions off, or else you're basically ceding that possession. You're ceding that you're not going to score. You know, I think one of the guys on the broadcast mentioned it. There was about a 3-4 possession stretch where LeBron really wasn't involved, and he was kind of tugging on his shorts. And you think he's tired, so he's trying to take these possessions off, but he just can't.
Well, yeah. I mean, not only did he take possessions off, there was one sequence where he wasn't even in the frame on the broadcast.
Yeah.
In that fourth quarter, there was I'm watching. I'm like, wait, there's four yellow jerseys. Where's the fifth one? And it was a possession where Cleveland got at least one offensive rebound. So it was a longer sequence where it stood out. I'm like, why are there only four guys? Is somebody hurt? What's going on? And then, you know, they missed both their shots or whatever. Warriors get the rebound. And you see LeBron James is at half court. It's like, you can't do that. You know, I mean, I think a better way would be to, you know, if you're that tired and you're LeBron James, why not run some sets basically like you would at the end of a game, where, you know, somebody's dribbling the ball, you know, at the top of the three-point arc, and just dribbling down the shot clock, you know, and then going with 4 or 5 seconds left. I mean, I think that's a better way to do it than have LeBron just standing at half court and, you know, the Cavaliers basically trying to play 4-on-5.
Yeah, it was tough to watch because I don't know if this is the right word, but it almost started to feel a little unfair. Like you watched guys that looked like they were running in mud, him and Dellavedova. You know, they were both cramping up. They both had to put the ice towels on their heads. This is the first time I think I can recall Dellavedova actually calling over to the sideline and asking to be taken out. Like, he physically couldn't go anymore. And but the thing is, you know, I heard some of the criticism on the Cavaliers' part for heading into Game 5 is like, okay, what does David Blatt do to counter now? We saw Steve Kerr make his big move. What is David Blatt going to do? And in my head, I'm like, he really can't do much. He doesn't have the depth and of the seven guys he's leaning on, like, two or three of them were fairly non-existent yesterday. Like, J.R. Smith couldn't throw it in the ocean yesterday. James Jones went 0-for-3 with no points. And Iman Shumpert went 2-for-9. So that trio, that's three of the seven guys that David Blatt has to lean on, gave him a combined 9 points. So, you know, there is no chess move for David Blatt to make. I really don't know what else he can do besides just hope that this extra day of rest gets his guys reinvigorated and they could go back to that kind of staunchy defensive style of play.
Yeah, LeBron said that after the game. There really are no adjustments. I mean, you can do some things maybe to try to slow the Warriors down, you know, with that smaller lineup. But personnel wise, there's nothing you could do to match. What are you going to do? Put in Kendrick Perkins, you know, Mike Miller. I don't know what Sean Marion's deal is, if he's healthy or not. You know, maybe you could steal some minutes with him. You know, he's a guy that can give you some defense and rebounding maybe. But beyond that, there's nothing. I mean, and we talked about this. You know, the Cavaliers' depth. We said it after Game 3 when we talked about what we might see the rest of the series. We said with the one-day rest, you know, the depth might be a factor. And we looked back at the Clippers in the first round of the playoffs, the second round of the playoffs against the Rockets. They were up 3-1 in that series, but the Clippers only go 7 deep. So as the series, you know, progresses, you saw fatigue was a factor for them in fourth quarters of games. Blake Griffin was non-existent. You know, everybody else starts to tighten up, miss some shots. And it becomes a real issue. So we've seen it. I mean, playing at this level, you have to be able to go deeper than 7. And if you're not going deeper than 7, LeBron said this afterwards also, you can't shoot 4 of 27 from 3-point distance and expect to have a shot. I mean, the Cavaliers killed the Warriors on the boards. I think that's something that'll continue with these lineups. 10 more offensive rebounds. Gave Cleveland 11 more field goal attempts than the Warriors had in this game, but they made 7 fewer. So, you know, at some point, guys like J.R. Smith, Dellavedova, I mean, J.R. Smith 0 of 8 from 3, Dellavedova 2 of 9 from 3. You can't have that from those guys. You just can't if you're going to expect to win. At some point, you need to start knocking down some shots. I think fatigue is a big part of it. What we're experiencing right now, I think it's huge that Cleveland gets 2 days off before the next game, you know, back in Golden State. But really, there are no adjustments to be made at this point.
No, there really aren't. But I want to go back to the lineup change that Steve Kerr made. What do you think they actually did, like, significantly different on offense and on defense? Because I think there was a couple. It's not just inserting Andre Iguodala in, and just obviously spacing is a big part of it. But I also think they started to run some things differently on their offense, specifically with some of their pick and roll stuff.
Well, I think they looked to push, you know, and LeBron, you know, again, LeBron is as good of an analyst of the game as any of us are. You know, it's very different, the Warriors getting into their sets and starting their offense off of rebounds as opposed to taking it out of the net if the Cavaliers are scoring baskets. You know, that's extra seconds that, you know, the Cavaliers have to sort of set their defense. And when, you know, you get a rebound, maybe a quick outlet pass. We saw Andre Iguodala get loose for a couple of dunks in transition.
Yep.
You know, they were really looking to push the ball up. They used passes instead of dribbling to advance the ball. You know, that could have been an adjustment, you know, intentionally. I just think that if you look at these possessions that the Warriors had on offense, they were much quicker just all over the floor. And I think when you have Bogut, you know, he's more of a slogging guy. He'll set screens. He might roll to the basket.
That's putting it kindly, too, that he's
slogging. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, but with Iguodala out there, you know, he's more nimble. There's more spacing. You know, Bogut isn't shooting threes. So Iguodala is. He knocked down, you know, a few three-pointers.
He was four of nine.
Yeah, four of nine. So, you know, he spaces the floor that way, which creates, you know, creates lanes for the ball handlers. And look, everybody is just on the Warriors was just running around in those half-court sets much more quickly than we've seen. And I think, again, going back to it, a big reason is that the Cavaliers are too tired to stay up in their jerseys the way that they had the last two games.
Definitely. I'm looking at the minutes distribution right now, too. And again, it's a little skewed when the game gets out of hand. But I think taking Bogut's minute, because Bogut played 3 minutes and he was just out there to hack people. So he pretty much I'm pulling up his box score right now. He went 17 minutes, 25 minutes, and 28 minutes in games 3, 2, and 1. So taking those minutes and allocating them more towards your backcourt, I think made a lot of sense. Like a guy that was getting a lot of pub for his play last night was Sean Livingston. He was, I know plus regular plus minus isn't the best indicator, but he was plus 25 in 25 minutes. And I'm pretty sure that's the most minutes he's played all series. Just kind of having that havoc on the wings of guys that can switch pick and rolls on defense. They can all get out in transition and they can all do something with the ball. The ball won't necessarily stop when it hits their hands on offense, which I think was a big thing. I think what I liked a lot, and I think this is a subtle difference that they did with their offense, was, you know, the pick and roll, I thought Curry was still doing a good job of kind of doing that pocket pass or that over-the-top pass, and the roller.
Right.
The roller was Draymond, who, to his credit, he played a lot better and he finished a lot better. And the other roller was David Lee, who's a good decision maker. He missed some bunnies at the rim, but I think just the fact that you have to defend him as he's going to the basket's a big deal. But another thing is I think they did a lot more straight-up isolation plays with Curry to not bring a second defender and trust that he's going to – like his offensive talent's going to win out. I still don't think he had that great of a game. I think he still struggled a little bit. But I think that helped him kind of let the offense run through him and gain a little bit of confidence in that he can beat certain guys one-on-one.
Yeah, so through these first four games – obviously, the series isn't over yet. It's tied 2-2. But like Andre Iguodala is the Finals MVP at this point, if it were to be over. And I'm not saying he's going to win Finals MVP if the Warriors end up winning the series, because you know it only takes one game for you know if it's you know whatever 3-2 or 3-3, and then Curry goes for 40 points in a series clincher, he's going to end up with
the MVP.
He's going
to get it.
But but right now, I mean, consistency. The way Curry shot in this series overall, I mean, you have to look at Iguodala being the Warriors' best player.
Yeah, he has through, and that's the funny thing. It's like when you're judging the playoffs and in certain series, it's kind of tough. Like you have to judge them almost in a vacuum, you know. Like I know what Steph Curry's done all season, and he was great all season, but through these four games. Andre Iguodala has been the Warriors' most consistent best player, especially when you consider what he brings on the defensive side of the ball. I think if you were taking a vote right now and being completely objective, he would have to be the leading candidate from the Warriors' side. There's also the conversation of, you know, even if the Warriors went out and LeBron plays like he did in games 1, 2, and 3, could we see a guy like him actually win the trophy even if his team loses? Something that hasn't happened in, I don't know, 40 years, I think, since Jerry West did it. Like, I'm pretty sure that's the only time in league history it's ever happened.
Yeah, that would be tough. I mean, LeBron would have to basically put up the same numbers he's put up the first three games and do it the rest of the series. I mean, because, you know, he's 2 assists away from a triple-double in this one, but 20 points, 12 rebounds, 8 assists, that's not MVP numbers, but the 40s, he was basically averaging over the first three.
You say over the first three, but it's a three game series now, so it's very possible that he could.
You know? Yeah, sure. All right. Well, before we sort of shift our focus to Game 5, let's talk quickly about the LeBron James cameraman play.
Oh, definitely.
You know, he gets fouled, lands awkwardly off balance, ends up going head first into the front row, bangs his head, you know, on a television camera, gets, you know, two cuts basically that he needed to have, you know, bleeding from his head. He said, you know, you could see him say right afterwards, you know, that Cavaliers wanted to take him out, and he, you know, he's smart enough. He says, no, I have to shoot these free throws or I can't come back in the rest of the game.
Yeah.
So he knew exactly what was going on. You know, some people were saying, oh, that was a flop. You know, Andrew Bogut, I think, said he jumped into the cameraman. Mm-hmm. I just think he was off balance. I don't think he was flopping. You know, he was already balanced at that point. You know, what did you see on that play, and what are your thoughts? You know, he avoided the, you know, dreaded concussion protocol. Basically said he was fine. It was just a cut. What did you see on that play?
Yeah, you know, he said, and I'm pretty sure he said he had a light headache after the game too.
Right.
So that's another thing. But I definitely think Bogut took full advantage of knowing that he's not playing a lot, so he's got to go out there and use his fouls and kind of and put a little extra stuff on it. I don't think it was a flop, you know? Bogut definitely hit him in the air, body checks him, and then you can see towards the end of the play, he gives him like a little shove, like a little love tap, and it doesn't look like much, but when you remember that Andrew Bogut's 7 foot 260, you know,
yeah,
like that's going to move somebody. And like you said, he was falling, he was off balance, and I think one of the things when NBA players are going to the ground, they don't want to like land on their wrist or slam on their shoulder. So you see them a lot of times as they start to fall, they kind of do like a little lunge forward so they can like fall and slide. And I think that's what LeBron was trying to do, and he hit his head on the camera guy. And that started the whole conversation about these guys being way too close to the floor, which I agree with. I think they're so close to the action, especially when you watch these guys come on full speed in transition or even in the half court. They're moving so fast, and there's so little space between the baseline and where those camera guys sit. You know, and it's not the first time we've seen guys fall and get hurt into the camera people. It's the most high profile player in a finals game. It's going to bring a lot of attention to that play.
Yeah, you know, when you mentioned it doesn't take much for guys to go flying, you know, once they go airborne. You know, there was a play later in the game where, you know, Sean Livingston's on a fast break and LeBron reaches in,
he shoves,
you know,
him
to stop him. Yeah, he shoved him in the back. You know, he just gave him a little push and Livingston went flying.
Yeah,
you know,
LeBron's not little either.
Yeah, and they didn't look at it as a flagrant or anything like that, but, you know, just that plays on just more evidence that it really doesn't take much. And again, I think absolutely the cameraman are too close to the baseline. I don't know why we need a television angle from there. You know, we see the game at so many different angles. You know, player safety with all the injuries that we've had, you know, all throughout the regular season, all throughout the playoffs, you know, guys going down for various reasons. We don't need another, you know, cause of injury or potential cause of injury by having cameras that close to the action. You know, I don't know. I don't know if the league's ever going to look at it. You know, it's been a problem for years.
Yeah.
We'll see what they say. You know, who knows? You know, the league's broadcast partners that pay, you know, $2 billion for the rights to televise these games, they might have something to say about it.
For
you
sure.
Know, they might feel that that's valuable, but
yeah.
I thought it was interesting. I mean, just, it's a crazy play. You know, you see the best player in the game take cuts to the head and basically remain in the game. It's just insane.
Yeah, and a few things people pointed out. You know, that was an NBA TV camera. So
right.
that's like the league's television network, I guess, was the, not the culprit, but were the ones that were sitting that close. I know Greg Popovich, someone retweeted what he said. I think it was after a finals game where someone fell into the camera guys, and he said it's like when there's a dangerous street with no stop sign, and everybody in the town is begging for someone to put up a stop sign, and they don't do it until there's a car crash. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, no one's gonna say anything until somebody gets really hurt, and it has to be a high profile player. Thankfully, LeBron wasn't too hurt, but one of the things I immediately thought of is if Players Association President Michelle Roberts, or Player Director Michelle Roberts, is willing to go scorched earth on so many small things to defend the players, like, she's gonna go hard at this. I feel like, especially if the top level players go to her and say, like, we want this changed, you know? She's willing to eviscerate the NBA on things like their awards and media guys being in the locker room an hour before the game. Like, if she really takes this seriously as a player safety issue, I think you could see it become a big deal once they kick off negotiations again.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, she's definitely taken a hard line against seemingly small things and ridiculous things. But remember, you know, she's basically an unknown to the players. She has to, you know, basically take their side.
Absolutely.
On issues. So basically she's just earning, you know, those credibility points early on, way before labor negotiations. I mean, she's an extremely accomplished, smart woman. There's no way she doesn't know what she's doing. So she's taking that stance now, basically so that later on when she has to make the hard decisions, the players are going to be like, all right, well, she has our back. You know, she's proven it. I think that's what it's about more than anything else. It's a lot of posturing. There are definitely serious issues that the Players Association should be concerned with, and, you know, beyond media, creating their own awards, you know, and some other nonsense like that.
Yeah, that stuff seems trivial when it looks like LeBron has two open wounds in the middle of a finals game on the back of his head.
Yeah, and not to mention all the financial stuff, right? I mean, the disparity between what the owners share and the players share and all that type of stuff. There's a lot of financial things that need to be worked out. Mm-hmm. You know, the not looking to smooth in the salary cap increase, you know, just allowing it to spike like crazy once that broadcast rights deal kicked in. I mean, that's going to have some crazy unintended consequences. I don't think, I mean, Adam Silver has said as much, that I don't think we're going to be able to predict until they happen. It's going to be super interesting to see how crazy the contracts get for, you know, role players and guys that maybe don't deserve it.
Yeah.
It's going to be super interesting.
Definitely.
All right, well, let's look ahead to Game 5 now. So obviously after Game 3, you know, Game 4 became a must-win for the Golden State Warriors. If you fall down 3-1, you know, you're pretty much done. I mean, Warriors now, certainly in the driver's seat with two of the potentially next three games being played in their building. What are you looking to see out of Game 5? It's basically, you know, a must-win situation, I think, for the Cavaliers, because you fall down 3-2, you give the Warriors two chances to close this thing out. That's not going to be good, especially with one potentially in their building. What do you expect to see in Game 5?
Yeah, you know, our fellow podcaster who isn't here, Kurt, he said that he believes whoever won this past game, Game 4, is going to win the series.
Historically, that's been true.
Yeah. So I guess it wasn't that big of a limb he went out on, but still. I think, you know, I definitely think that it's a must-win game for the Cavaliers in the sense that I know they can win in Golden State, but I don't think they're going to win a Game 6 and a Game 7, especially one on the road. I think that I expect that their level of intensity will pick up because of the extra day's rest, but I don't know if that's necessarily enough. You know, I saw a lot of deficiencies in that team. I think they were exposed when Steve Kerr pulled out Andrew Bogut and kind of made it an even 5-on-5 on both ends of the floor. You know, like, it was clear as day that they were playing 4-on-5 on the offensive side of the ball. So I expect for them to pick up their intensity, but I'm leaning more towards Golden State in this game. I think going back home to Oracle Arena, you know, they still got an awesome record there, even with the Game 2 loss. So I'm definitely leaning more towards Golden State.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, again, predictions at this point are basically impossible. But I think what we can expect is a much more similar style of play from the Cavaliers with a couple days rest. I mean, that's basically the only thing that they can hang their hat on at this point. We talked about it earlier. You know, they don't have the depth. They don't have the luxury of making lineup changes the way the Warriors do. They have to win with their grit, with their hustle, with their high level of activity on the defensive end of the floor. You know, and more than anything, they have to make more shots. They can't shoot what they shot from three-point distance in this one. You know, again, 11 more field goal attempts than the Warriors, but made 7 fewer. So they have to make some shots. Warriors' best defensive team in the league all season long. You know, certainly looked like it, you know, in Game 4. I definitely expect a much better effort out of the Cavaliers, one more similar to what we saw the first three games of the series on the defensive end of the floor. I expect LeBron James to be a little bit more aggressive offensively. It's not about the 22 field goal attempts. It's about, you know, him sort of having his fingerprints on every offensive possession or on as many as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, he needs some guys to make shots. Otherwise, it's not going to be possible, basically, for the Cavaliers to win this series. But, you know, the way the Warriors may have found something, you know, with this lineup change. So I expect a closer game from Cleveland. I don't expect them to get blown out by 21 points again. But you're right. I don't know if they have the personnel at this point to be able to cause the type of problems they caused earlier in the series.
Yeah, you know, and tactically, you know, I think one of the changes that they kind of downplayed in Game 4, and I actually expect to see more of in Game 5, is I thought they hedged out on LeBron a lot more on pick and rolls. I thought they did a lot more severe traps. Like, it wasn't a half-hearted trap. It was a true trap of him to move the ball out of his hands, and there was a lot more aggressive doubling when he was in the post. And it still wasn't a full double team like I would like to see, but it was a hard enough double that it kind of got him to stop, move the ball, and then the team kind of got away from reposting him. And even he kind of got away from reposting himself. You know, like, he would start to post, there would a double would come, he would kick it out, and then he would kind of float back out to the perimeter. And I know, I'm pretty sure I heard David Blatt and Steve Kerr both kind of downplay how they changed up their coverage on him. They both said, yeah, we did it a little bit, but not really. I actually thought, you know, they did it enough. I don't think it's one of those things where you change your game plan totally. I think you just try and throw different looks, and you kind of make them a little harder and a little more intense. Like, I don't know. Personally, for me, just watching the game, I thought that was a big reason why LeBron kind of, you know, the fatigue was a big factor. But I think he was a little more, like, kind of feeling out how they were doing that instead of just full-on attacking. And I think we could see more of that in Game 5.
Yeah, that's a good point about the feeling out process. You know, anytime a lineup change happens, you know, LeBron said afterwards, you know, a couple times, he said, like, so with this new lineup, you know, what do we do here? You know, what do we do? Sort of, like you said, feeling it out, you know, trying to figure it out on the fly. So maybe he was a little bit more tentative. You know, Steve Kerr was asked about his coverages after the game, and he basically said, nah, you know, it was more about our activity level, which obviously comes from rhythm when you look at the way the Warriors were able to get into their sets more quickly, mm-hmm. and the speedier lineup with Andre Iguodala on the floor over Andrew Bogut. So you're right. I think the eye test will tell you that the Warriors were more aggressive in both soft and hard double teams of LeBron James, but I think that's an excellent observation that he was maybe thinking too much instead of attacking and just, you know, going with what's worked in the first few games.
Definitely, just like, it was one of those things where he kind of went away from the post in this game. I thought we didn't see too many of those, like, dominating, like, LeBron looks like he has a ragdoll on him type of plays, you know? And it's one of those things where even if he doesn't necessarily hit the, like, the mid-range turnaround and the mid-range hook, it sinks everybody on the floor into the paint. It kind of shrinks the floor, and that benefits the Cavaliers because they're the bigger team and they're better on the offensive boards. And, again, it also forces the gang rebounding from the Warrior side, so that way they can't just leak out in transition. Andre Iguodala can't just watch a shot go up and then just start streaking down the court and basically get an uncontested dunk.
Yeah, Iguodala at times, man, he looked like the fastest player out there on some of those possessions, the way he was, you know, getting out in transition, especially to start the game.
Definitely. And, you know, all these guys, they all say the right things. I think a lot of those guys are very polished with how they deal with the media and how they hide their frustration or I guess kind of present themselves. But, you know, and they brought it up on the broadcast a lot. This is a guy who started every game of his career up until this season. You know, this is a guy who averaged, you know, 18, 20 points a game for 4 years straight with the 76ers. Like, he probably thinks, like, he gets the news, like, I'm in the starting lineup, and he's like, all right, like, you want to bench me for the whole series and put me on the bench, like, watch what I'm going to do now. And I think he came out with a point to prove, and I think he proved it.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's been by far, you know, for the Warriors, the most consistent player in the series on both ends of the floor. All right, well, good stuff as always. We will be back with you on Monday after Sunday night's Game 5. Break it all down one more time. So for Dominic Ridgard, I'm Brett Polakoff, and we will see you guys next time.